Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is the Monday after CPAC, and I have to say that I did not miss not being down in Orlando. We can talk about that for a moment, but I know that our own Tim Miller was monitoring it 24/7. So I appreciate taking one for the team, Tim. Good morning, happy Monday.
Good morning, Charlie. It was in Candor, more like 14-2. But I did the most that one could do to get the gist of it. You know, if you were monitoring the actual CPAC, you know, you'd dip out for a while and head down to the bar in order to tolerate it. Obviously, I couldn't do that via YouTube, so you know, I had to just put down the laptop and head downstairs and get a glass of rosé. It was my version of that. So I didn't catch every single speaker, but I'm pretty sure I got the gist of it.
I need to work up to it. I need to work up to Trump's speech and the whole thing. But I did learn a new word this morning that I thought I would share with the audience. Okay. Actually, it's an old word. I think probably once I knew what it was, but I'd forgotten until I saw it in a Bill Kristol email. He used the word. He's writing about. He's got a fantastic piece in the Bulwark today, where he talks about the facts of life, and it's kind of a follow up to his piece saying, hey, if we're going to save democracy, maybe we should work with the pro-democracy people, even if they're Democrats. If in fact we're facing authoritarian fascism, maybe we ought to ally with whoever is also going to oppose authoritarian fascism. And he got a lot of blowback on that from people who said that we conservatives cannot do that. We cannot take sides. We need to just speak truth, whatever that is, and not do what Bill Kristol is doing and actually aligning with people who are defending democratic values and things like that. So he wrote this really good response and was basically saying that, you know, he's not going to war. He wants to have a discussion. He wants to have something. And he said that he thought his piece was irenic. I-R-E-N-I-C. Okay, so Tim Miller, you're a wordsmith. Did you go, I have to look that up? Because I did.
I thought he did a typo of ironic.
No. People will think that. No, it's ironic, and it means aiming or aimed at peace. You know, it's actually like, for example, you know, a part of Christian theology concerned with reconciling different denominations and sects. So this was peaceful. Like, let's not fight. We're not going to war with one another. Come, let us reason together. Bill Kristol was being ironic. We don't have a lot of ironic moments with the Bulwark.
Yeah, I was going to say, as I mentioned last week, I was looking for an opportunity to put calumny into an article, and I succeeded because there's a lot of calumny out there. But I don't. It might be challenging to sneak ironic into an article, but I'm going to do my best over the next few weeks. So keep an eye out.
All right. So also, being late to the game is because, of course, now we're going to get like a million emails, people saying, "Charlie, how could you not have understood what the name were? You know, I mean, we thought you were an educated guy." Well, here's something else where I am way late to the party on. Okay, have you been reading a lot of the Woody Allen, Mia Farrow stuff?
You know, I did back in the day, and I feel like I've gotten my fill.
Yeah, well, there's more. I mean, let's say that I'm sorry. All families have their problems. This family, and of course, they've broken into factions where there's the pro Mia faction and there's the pro Woody faction,
right.
And Moses is one of the kids, and he's very pro Woody, and he's issued a statement. And so I'd actually, you know, read about Moses for some, you know, time and understood where he was coming from and that he was very critical. And it was only when I was talking about this with my wife this morning and she said his name that I got it. You know what his name is? His full name?
No.
Moses Farrow.
Oh my gosh.
Are you kidding me? Moses Farrow. Oh, it had never occurred to me. I've read that. I don't know if I've ever spoke. You have to say it out loud. We go, oh man, I get it. Okay. So they're all sitting around going, what do we name the young Pharaoh baby? Let's name him Moses Pharaoh. Okay. This has nothing to do with anything we're going to talk about
or
today.
Or with young Pharaoh at CPAC. Yeah. I do have to say, I read, Luke Russert's mother, late Tim Russert's wife, wrote about this in Vanity Fair many years ago. And Mia has been a long time, Twitter DMer of us, mm-hmm. of us Never Trumpers. And so I've always sided on Team Mia, and Woody seems pretty creepy. That was kind of the extent of where I landed on the teams, but I've not dug into like episode 4 of the 4-part documentary series on this.
It's 4 parts. See, I only wanted to just do the pun name thing. I didn't want to get into this. I didn't want to get into the substance of this in any way whatsoever.
Well, that's dangerous territory.
Here's maybe an explanation for my mood today. Our producer, Jim Swift, our colleague, had pulled all kinds of audio from Trump's speech yesterday at CPAC and everything. And I went through them all and I realized, you know what? I just don't want to listen to that guy's voice anymore. One of the best things about watching that speech was, wow, it is so great that I don't have to put up with this on a daily basis anymore. So this is my gift to you, Tim, and to the audience of the Bulwark Podcast. You're not going to have to listen to his voice anymore. So,
do you want a little pro tip on this, Charlie?
It
doesn't completely protect you from this, but if you feel like you have to watch. So I was, it was my husband's birthday yesterday, so we were at the beach during the speech, so I was not watching it live. I felt like, to do my service for the listeners here and knowing I was going to be on the podcast today, I should at least watch it. And so last night before bed, I put the whole thing on at 2.25 speed on YouTube. And so he like sounds like a chipmunk. And that does take away a little bit of like your physical response to hearing his voice. So if you feel like you have to listen to him for work purposes,
if it's desperate, that's
a little pro tip.
You had a fantastic piece, a newsletter yesterday about this, arguing that maybe CPAC was the Republican base all along. I've always thought of it as, and I guess we need now to retire the whole Star Wars bar scene thing and everything. It's crazy stuff. I love, by the way, the anatomy of who used to show up. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
And anyone, and this inside stuff, but if you've ever been to CPAC, aging, and it was the dazzling detail of the, aging Reagan era aide with dandruff flecked suit. Boring everybody with his stories, and that's the, and the guys on the make and all of this stuff. But okay, so give me your
for one of the listeners. I did get a good Twitter response, which was from a guy who's like, I'm reading all of these people going, thank goodness that's not me, thank goodness that's not me, thank goodness that's not me. And then he gets to the penultimate bullet, and it's upper middle class Republican activist who is an active blog commenter and has just enough money to blow on a vacation to DC in the hopes of meeting Ed Morrissey. And he's like, woof, I felt seen by the second to last bullet. Ouch.
But
I do want, during this, as part of this effort for the article, Charlie, I wanted to make sure my memory didn't deceive me, because before we get into this week's CPAC, part of this was trying to reflect back on CPACs of yesteryear. And so I went to 4 CPACs, and so I quizzed some of my friends who accompanied me and who I tried to maintain ironic detachment with in the corner. They helped with some of our archetypes. I also watched some of the old speeches. It also occurred to me that CPAC 2013 was the time that I met Charlie Sykes. Now, you wouldn't have remembered me because I was just a measly little hack trying to help Reince Priebus. But this memory struck because I went back to rewatch Reince's speech, which was on the eve of when we were going to release the autopsy. And I was managing the PR around the autopsy. I don't know why I ever got hired again after that. I chased you down backstage in the hopes that, you would be, because of your fondness for Reince and, general normalness, might be a rare voice of praise for the autopsy. So we briefly met back then.
Okay. So, I did like the autopsy and did give rare words of praise, but that wasn't me because I wasn't at CPAC 2013.
No, come on.
No, it's not me. No, no. So, with some other nerdy looking guy with glasses and black hair.
Was it 2015 then?
2016 is the only year that I was there. I only went there when my wife used to go on a regular basis. She used to work for the Bradley Foundation and they sponsored the Reagan dinner. So she was a veteran of the Star Wars bar scene.
I guess we never had met them. Maybe it was like Craig Gilbert or something.
It was somebody like
Wisconsin political.
He's way better looking than me. So you would have you've gotten this. Okay, so I had my take on this, which was very serious and everything. But I guess speaking of like flashbacks, remember when they used to have to give you a sense of what CPAC was like, they used to have the straw poll, and every year it was won by Ron Paul, because the Ron Paul people showed up in huge numbers. So that implies that you had all of these young libertarian zealots there. Whatever the hell happened to those people? Are they gone, or did they simply move from Ron Paul to Donald Trump?
For the most part, they simply moved from Ron Paul to Donald Trump. And I think that, you know, it's pretty interesting. One of these days, if you could stomach it, we should have like a, you know, one of Rand's consultants on here, who I think could talk about that. Because it is kind of a surprising, you know, just sort of political anthropology. But I think that there was a very small percentage, and this is kind of reflective of basically the whole reflection I wrote in the article. There's a small percentage of serious libertarians. But behind that, there was basically just this anti-establishment, you know, own the elites, a little bit about own the libs, but in, I think their case, it was, you know, it was mostly this negative reaction worthy to the industrial, you know, military complex and to kind of the, you know, this sort of coastal, elite, moderate, neocon, whatever you want to call it, dominance of the Republican Party. And then there was also this, you know, this strain of racism that underlined the Ron Paul movement. And you remember his writings for the Von Mises Institute. And, he had gotten called out about that, but said, oh, well, you know, this was a ghostwriter. Maybe it was a ghostwriter. But I think that signaled that there was a lot of this anti-immigrant, anti-Civil Rights Act. Remember Rand Paul got in trouble in his first campaign for being against saying he was against the Civil Rights Act on libertarian principle. So I do think this kind of anti-war and racial elements to the Paul movement did move rather seamlessly into Trumpism. And it maybe wasn't this kind of pure live and let live libertarianism that maybe, the outsiders to it might have projected.
Well, that's an interesting point, because people say, you know, that once you're into conspiracy theories, you're open to every other conspiracy theory and you just move from one to another. And maybe that's the same with, you know, crackpotism as well. That once you've sort of gone down that particular rabbit hole, you go into all the different Warrens. So, okay, so I guess I'm kind of bored with some of the takes on all of this. It's Donald Trump's party, Donald Trump. Okay, the Trumpification of the Republican Party, we got it. But I will say that what was really interesting to me was watching this gathering of conservatives less than 2 months after the insurrection of the Capitol, year after 500,000 Americans died from the pandemic, and you would never know that it happened. I mean, not only are they unrepentant, but there's no reflection. There's no sense of, hey, we need to have an autopsy. We need to like think through our values. You know, maybe we really ought to ask ourselves some hard questions about the future, about violence and sedition, and, you know, whether, you know, how we distance ourselves from white supremacy or the dangers of cults of personality. There was none of that. Hey, we need to take a second look at all of this. I mean, there was no thoughtfulness whatsoever. And again, this all happened so recently, and the ability of the conservatives just to simply flip the switch is still remarkable, even though we've seen it before. And also just the extent to which they have completely gone into the denial and delusion about the election, the big lie. We kind of knew that the big lie was going to be one of the litmus tests, but the extent to which the entire right and the Republican Party has now decided that we're going to believe the election was stolen and all of the implications of that. I mean, you really had it on display this weekend. In case there was any doubt whatsoever that there was going to be a quote-unquote Republican civil war, a fight for the soul of the Republican Party, I mean, you know, there's going to be some straggling skirmishes, but that's done, isn't it? I mean, it is done.
Yeah, I mean, a lot there, Charlie. The most striking moment of that was, for me, watching Tom Cotton's speech. Because Tom Cotton honestly gave a speech that could have been, that like must have been written on January 5th, or could have been.
Yeah, right.
But he gives this very extensive, you know, section about Black Lives Matter protests over last summer and Antifa. And he's using this rhetoric about how, you know, we can't submit to the mob and how we need to black the blue and, you know, how
it can never happen. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like this whole time he's talking about this, I keep saying he's going to at least make an aside, you know, which is like, this wasn't, you know, what happened on January 6th was not what our movement was about or something like that. Right. Like one sentence, right, at least, and nothing. So he just gives this entire speech about standing up to the mob and defending the police, and does not mention the Trump flag wearing mob riot that killed a cop like 5 weeks ago. Right. I mean, just astounding. And then, you know, on COVID, the two kind of hot names out of the CPAC, but that aren't in the Trump family, were Kristi Noem and Ron DeSantis.
Yeah.
You know, Ron DeSantis gets credit. You know, we could spend all day on Ron DeSantis. And the kind of debate over why, like, the liberals think he was the worst response to COVID and Republicans think he was the best, when really he's kind of like in the middle.
Yeah.
But, you know, his whole shtick is that, like, you know, he did everything perfect with the coronavirus by leaving everything open. And you know, he just talks over the deaths. Kristi Noem, you know, is bragging about how hers was the only state in the country that didn't shut down anything, and just doesn't even mention, or just kind of rolls right over the fact that South Dakota, since July, has the highest death rate from COVID-19 in the world, like of any state in America and of any country in the world since July.
But she's the female hotter Trump.
Yeah. And so, but people, they don't care, right? It's cheers, cheers, cheers. I wonder if we have South Dakota listeners, I would like to hear from you. It's like this, the disconnect. I mean, you know, one in like six people in South Dakota have died from COVID-19 in the past year. I mean, how does that sound? I have to imagine that those people know someone, you know, in their community who's died from it. Anyway, you know, but she just is on Earth B, and everybody in this room, by the way, you know, again, tight enclosed space, you know, conference ballroom, you know, we're still in the middle, the pandemic isn't over yet. Hope might be in the horizon, but it's not over. You know, cheering, shouting for her, in this Earth B. So, yeah, and we can talk about more about, you know, how some of them responded to the insurrection and all that, but the unreality of just kind of pretending like those deaths didn't happen, pretending that coup attempt didn't happen, was consistent throughout.
It was
throughout the speakers.
No, and I think there was one guy that pushed back against the big lie about Charlie Spies, who pushed back, and some woman said, "What are you gonna do about these voting machines that switch the votes?" And he says that did not happen. And of course, he got heckled and booed and all of that stuff, and he was clearly the outlier. The other speakers, though, and I had a couple of, you know, reactions watching some of the videos. This problem, the Republican Party, the after Trump Republican Party, because if this was an audition for some of them, I mean, you really got a sense of how tinny and weak and diminished they were. I mean, there's Josh Hawley, who's not only playing the I am populist bullshit card, but I am the victim, and they want to cancel me, and they tried to censor me, and they want to do all this, but I am still standing here. It's like, give me a break. I mean, he feels like his kid dressed up in his, you know, much larger dad's clothing or something like that. He's just, you know, trying to, you know, pretend that, you know, here's the guy from, I don't, what is he? Is he Princeton, Stanford? All these guys from Princeton and Harvard talking about, you know, the working men. But then there was Ted Cruz. Did you catch Ted Cruz's speech? I am William Wallace.
Sadly, I got that one live.
I am a much fatter, hairier William Wallace. Makes the joke about going to Cancun. I just, or this one. The Republican Party is not the party of the country clubs. It's the party of hardworking blue-collar men and women. Okay, high lob for Tim Miller. The Republican Party is not the party of the country clubs. High lob. Go for it.
Yeah, you like the Ritz-Carlton, you mean, or like Mar-a-Lago? Or which country club? Yeah, Trump Doral? Yeah. Which country club are we talking about?
Trump literally lives in a country club. He freaking literally lives in a country club. Ted Cruz literally was staying at the fucking Ritz-Carlton in Cancun. Yeah. But we are not the party of the country.
How is this big working class Republican coalition doing in Texas with their, you know, $10,000 heating bills and, you know, not and opposing, you know, COVID relief? The whole thing is so phony. And, you know, we could just do another hour someday. I have this on my list of things to write about just on how unsturdy legs this kind of Republican multiracial working class coalition nonsense is. I mean, it's literally like the only people that actually believe that could happen are like the anti-Trump liberals like Glenn Greenwald. And then there are a couple of people that are cosplaying like they want it to happen, which is Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, but they're not, they won't actually ever do anything about it. You know, Hawley was like in a classic 80s movie villain, you know, yeah, role, you know, where he's the, you know, he's the rich kid, who's you know, the bad guy in the film. I just the standing ovation he received for voting to overturn the election stood
on January 6th. Yeah, no, see, that's one of the few references to the coup, to the insurrection, the bloody insurrection where five, depending on how you count it, five or six people died, was Hawley bragging about voting to overturn the election after that took place. And then he got a standing ovation for it. So at least he knows the base.
It's crazy. And, you know, he did only get 3% in the straw poll, which I guess we can talk about. But he, Cruz, then I think the other thing that's most interesting, and this was also very common throughout the speeches, Cruz, like, basically does a bad, like, stand-up routine. I'm trying to think of like who the conservative stand-up comedians are. I don't watch them, but so I like a bad version of whoever that must be. He doesn't talk at all like about policies, right? Or thing. I mean, Cruz originally ran as the like serious constitutional lawyer guy who is going to out debate the left, right? And he his whole shtick is about how the left hates comedy now. And like it was all Star Wars and Star Trek references. And then he talks about how Jerry Seinfeld can't make jokes anymore. And, you know, he tries to do a joke that wasn't that funny. And then he does the William Wallace voice. I mean, literally the whole speech is about how like the left isn't funny now. And how people that make anti-PC jokes on the right are getting canceled. I mean, it's like a Dennis, it's a bad Dennis Miller from is what it is. I just
that's good. Yeah, it's bad. Well, no, that's Dennis Miller actually can be funny though.
Have you seen Dennis Miller lately?
No, not good.
I'd recommend you pull up a recent Dennis Miller YouTube. he had his glory days. Don't get me wrong. I laughed, you know, back in the 90s. But no, his recent shtick is pretty stale.
So this is the thing about Ted Cruz. We've talked about this before, that he always gets the you know, pop culture references wrong, which is weird. You know, it's he's always one off there. So a couple of things. I mean, he's trying to make a joke about being Cancun. You know, hey, it's great being here in Orlando. Orlando is wonderful, not as nice as Cancun. Too soon, man. Really, there's people dying back in your home state while you were in Cancun. worst moment of your political life. You can't just laugh it off.
But yeah, but really can I quick just, on that?
I
like,
well, wait. I mean, what I thought was amazing was he's giving that speech the day that President Biden is in his home state of Texas looking at the disaster. And so the week after he leaves Texas to go to Cancun, he leaves Texas to go to Orlando. I mean, oh, my God.
I know. Crazy. And Matt, I just thought the contrast was interesting. Matt Gaetz, who, you know, I think has learned the lessons of Trumpism more than some of these other guys about what the crowd wants. Now, he's horrific at delivering, but the substance he's got right. He like alpha'd Ted during his remarks. He went up and like defended Ted whole hog and attacked the media for being obsessed with Ted, who's just going to Cancun with his family. And I thought that was really kind of an intriguing, subtle elbow at Ted for like being apologetic and not just, you know, giving the double middle finger to the media. So that, I mean, it's a good insight into where the mindset of the, you know, most warped, deranged MAGA mind is that like the
who's
mistake
more shameless
from Ted. Yeah, the mistake for Ted was not, you know, not caring about the people freezing to death in his state, but for having to pretend like he cares. That
he was insufficiently shameless.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, yeah. By the way, did we ever figure out what happened to Marco Rubio? He was supposed to speak on Saturday morning. He was on the schedule at 8:30 in the morning, and then he just wasn't there, and they had some lame video.
I didn't see what the news was on that. My Marco take that I was intrigued by is that he finished at 1% in the straw poll, even without Trump. So even in the Trumpless straw poll in his home state.
In Florida.
He finished at 1%. I mean, this is... You know, Jeb, we were not very popular at CPAC, as you might imagine. You know, we got 8% in 2015. Now, in fairness, we bust in a couple people. Yeah, please clap for us. That was a really robust 8%. We did bust in a couple people, you know, with our cash. But even still, you know, he's below. I just think that's an important kind of barometer because obviously we failed miserably. And so to be that far below our failing rate, it's crazy. Like that he's completely given himself and prostrated himself in front of the orange idol for nothing. For nothing. I mean, he has less than nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's gonna get humiliated. So, for example, I was just dragging him on Twitter before we started this podcast. He tweeted out this morning something from Daniel 9, you know, but to the Lord our God belong compassion and forgiveness, though we rebelled against him. And, of course, I subtweeted him and said, now do the bit about worshiping golden idols. I mean, it's too easy.
Too easy.
It's just too easy. The whole golden idol, golden calf thing. You know... But again, these guys never read a freaking book.
Yeah.
I mean, if they read a book or watched the movie, they'd know how that ended, right?
That is true. This was Trump during Trump's speech. He's talking about this Atlantic article that Molly Ball had, or no, sorry, Time Magazine article that Molly Ball had written about, you know, what the Democrats did for election protection to prepare for what was inevitable, the Trump trying to steal the election. And Trump just kept saying up there, just read the article, just go to Time and read the article. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, A, Trump hasn't read the article. Somebody told him that it was bad, because if he actually read the article, he'd realize it wasn't really anything scandalous. And two, nobody in this room is going to time.com to read Molly Ball's long read on election integrity. And Trump knows that they're not going to read it. He knows that he didn't read it. It's all just, it's like those fake libraries that the influencers bought to go to put behind their Zoom videos. Did you see that story? That's all.
Yeah,
it's like
no.
That in the MAGA form. Look, on the as far as this on the this kind of results in how much it was a Trump coronation, I did get some pushback from people who felt like that because he only got 55% in the CPAC straw poll that was maybe a sign of weakness. And I just want to tell any listeners who saw that and were looking for hope, do not feel hope about the Republican Party based on that or about Trump's softness with the base. I mean, for starters, he didn't get 50% in most of the primaries last time when he won. So, you know, getting to 50 is not necessary. So he's still gained in share from last time.
Well,
at the last CPAC, he only got 15%. Ted Cruz won the last CPAC. This is part about understanding, you know, my weekend newsletter, understanding the, you know, what is happening with CPAC and who attends. And it might seem like it's crazy people, but it's like the crazy ideologues instead of kind of the more, you know, just cultural grievance crowd that Trump appeals to. And I also just have to say, Joe, it's DeSantis, you know, DeSantis was stuffing the ballot box a little bit in his home state. You know, he wanted this bump. He gets up to 21%. 68% said they wanted to run again.
Okay,
I read that as a number who would say.
See, okay, let us disagree mildly here. Okay.
Please.
Okay, so
please.
So there were two,
trying to make
two,
me feel
two,
good.
Two number. No, we'll make you feel good. I'm just it's the 55% and who voted for him, and then there's 68% of the attendees wanted him to run again. Now that's interesting. I mean, this is the heart of MAGAverse. I mean, these are people who, you know, have had Trump stuff way more than 4 hours in a time. I mean, so the same group, this is 97% of these folks approve of Trump. I mean, these are People's Republic of Bulgaria election numbers. So I mean, 97%, and yet only 68% want him to run again, which would suggest that even in the heart, just the raw beating red meat heart of Trump land, there are some people going, hey, we love you, but can we just move on? Can we just do something different? The 68% one was more eyebrow raising for me. If I had eyebrows, I would have raised them.
Charlie, that's 2/3 of the conference. I mean, that's 67 points ahead of Marco.
This is 97% of these people love Trump. They love him, but only 68% wanted him to run again.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that you're in Orlando. You know, there are going to be a lot of Republican Florida DeSantis operative types who are trying to, you know, who want to push the vote. There are three Republicans from Florida who want to run for president themselves. I mean, this is not a scientific survey. George H.W. Bush had gone to the 1993 CPAC, he would have got like 4%.
Okay, that's true.
That
may be true, but this is like a convention of cannibals and finding out that 20% want a vegetarian meal for dinner or something. Yeah, vegan. I mean, it's like we're a vegan. There's a vegan convention and 20% want burgers for lunch. I mean, okay, something's wrong here. There's a little bit of dissonance here. I guess
if you want to squint at that and see some dissonance, I'm gonna let you. But I'm not getting my hopes up yet. I'm gonna have to see some more data.
So okay, so the speech really kind of was divided into. You can break it down in different ways. The very very low energy stuff that he was reading off the teleprompter, which was obviously written by Stephen Miller or somebody who writes as badly as Stephen Miller. And clearly that was not getting the crowd going. So Trump, who's pretty well attuned to the figures, I got to pull out the other stuff. I got to play the transgender card. I got to rip the critics. I have to read my enemies list out loud, which, you know, reading off the names of all of the people who needed to be killed. I mean, Richard Nixon also had an enemies list, but he never actually read it out loud in public. And so Trump's done one. So there was the much more red meat. Did you see Nikki Haley, by the way, who's having a hard time choosing her lane?
Oh, my gosh, Charlie. I mean, what are you doing?
And yeah, so she tweeted out, great speech, Mr. President. It was so substantive. Scott, my old friend Scott Walker, all in all, a very strong speech. If, of course, you leave aside the chronic lying, the bitterness, the grievance, the vengeance, all of that. Yeah, all in all, a strong speech.
The last 20 minutes of it is, I mean, as awful as some of the immigration and transgender stuff was, it's kind of standard fair conservative awfulness. The last 20 minutes of it is just wheels off election fraud and kill list.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like he is talking about the rigged how it was rigged, millions of votes, how they have to change it. He wants to change all the rules so people can only vote, you know, on election day going forward. I mean, even though he wins Florida in a state that has very lax, early voting requirements, the numbers were counted. You know, he's touching all of the, you know, the late night dumps and, you know, all of this nonsense that was the underpinning of the insurrection. Then he lists, you know, like you said, all 17 of the Republicans that voted to impeach him. It's like wild, rabid cheers. He talks about being vicious, how the Democrats are more vicious and how Republicans need to be more vicious in attacking their Democrats. I mean, the last 20 minutes was like a just kind of a low energy version of those Georgia rallies that came right before the Capitol was sieged. Yeah. I mean, it was the same stuff. You know, he said he's gonna have to beat him a third time. Be tough. I mean, all of these people, the worst of the worst, in my opinion, you know, and people that I'm never going to be able to get over, like the guy I wrote about last week, Chip Roy, the Nikki Haley's, the Marcos, the people who are like, who went around the Mitches after the impeachment and were like, well, my disagreement with the impeachment was on the merits of how the Democrats wrote the bill and the January exception and the blah blah blah, but still. What he did was unacceptable, and we can't continue down this path. You know, Rob Portman said he used the word unacceptable 8 times. What more do you want from me but to say unacceptable? Well, how about one person saying it's unacceptable for him to continue doing it? One person? None of them. Not Portman, not McConnell, not Rubio, not Chip Roy came out after Trump's speech and said, We can't continue down this path of lies, this panoply of lies. And then Nikki Haley goes out and says, great work, heck of a job keeping up the big lie. What is the plan here? And this to me goes back to the Bill article at the top.
Yeah.
Charlie is like about how you have to work with Biden. I mean, the people that criticize Bill, you know, at the National Review and Jonah and the others and then also the politicians, you know, who are mad about articles that the Roys and the Haleys and the Marcos, has any of them presented a plan for stopping this? I mean, as best as I can tell, the only plan for stopping, you know, the Republican Party's complete descent into anti-democratic conspiracy is praying that a judge puts Donald Trump in jail or that the hamburgers catch up with him. That's it.
That is the plan. That is that somehow it will magically go away, that somebody else will take care of this. Of course, that just doesn't happen. And this is the problem for the Republicans, because now that they are Trump's party, they are held hostage by this lie. They have to agree to this lie. They have to go along with this lie. They cannot challenge this lie. If they do challenge this lie, they're going to be Mike Pence'd, who, by the way, is, you know, in complete oblivion here. And so
1%, you know, actually, he was tied with Marco at 1%.
So this is why I think that Bill's piece is so important, because I'm trying to think what it was, the moment when something hit me. It was listening when I walk the dogs. I listen to Sirius XM radio, and there was some of the testimony from the acting Capitol Police Chief, who's talking about the plans of some of these militia groups to blow up the Capitol and kill multiple congressmen around the time of the State of the Union address. And then there was a report about all of the states that are using the big lie as a justification to roll back voting rights in one state after another. And I realized, you know, the attack on the Capitol, you know, it took place on January 6th, but what happened there is really ongoing. It didn't just happen and stop. And the fact that we're not willing to confront it, and the Republicans are not willing to tell the truth about it, in fact, that they're still acting on the same lie, would suggest that assault on democracy was not a one-time event on one day. It is an ongoing process. And therefore, when you're figuring out what do you do in American politics, I do think it's legitimate to say the number one challenge facing this country is to uphold constitutional democratic norms and values to make sure that this does not happen. And at that point, you ask yourself, OK, so what is the priority? Is it is it your party or is it the country? Is it, you know, whatever your quote unquote conservative conscience tells you, or what is actually happening in the world? And this is where I think Bill's point is, you know, quoting Margaret Thatcher, you know, be grounded in the facts of life. This is the reality right now. The fate of America is not going to be decided by the debate between a $12 an hour minimum wage and a $15 minimum wage, or a 36% top tax rate versus a 38% top tax rate. It's going to be decided on these questions of, you know, are we a democracy? Are we a constitutional republic? Or are we going to see another attack on our elections? And at that point, you go, hey, you know what? Maybe we ought to rethink some of the alliances and who we trust and who we don't trust and who we're willing to make temporary alliances with.
Yeah, and just like to that, to what the facts of life are, to what the actual truth is about our situation, the Republicans, the conservative movement had an opportunity 6 weeks ago to actually fight for the principles that they have claimed to uphold for, you know, the last 100 years, or even through back through, you know, the conservative revival with Buckley, etc. They had this opportunity in the wake of this tragedy, in the wake of this horror on January 6th. There was a moment where they could have, you know, fought for it clearly and put and said this is unacceptable and put a stake in, you know, the corrupting of what they claimed their principles were by Donald Trump. And many of them in that 24 hours after said that they were going to, and none of them have. And so how can you not look at the facts on the field and realize that this is not a fight that's right now that can be won within the conservative movement? Maybe it can in 10 years. I don't know. You know, who knows how the changes in the tectonic plates of our politics, you know, and what happens in the future. You know, maybe there a younger movement can arise, though, you know, the young conservatives at CPAC were like quasi-fascists, or not really quasi, actually just straight fascists. So I don't have a lot of hope for that. But, there was an opportunity over the last 6 weeks for the people who say, no, Bill, you are wrong. You know, working with the Democrats is not the best path forward. The Democratic Party is terrible, blah, socialism, blah, blah, blah. We have to do this within our own house. They had they were given this opportunity, this crisis to fight within their own house. And instead it's, we're just going to stay on the sidelines and stay detached and, you know, continue to call balls and strikes and continue to let Donald Trump run roughshod over the party. And hope for the best, you know, because it's just this one guy that's a problem. I mean, like it's a completely detached from reality observation of the facts in front of us. And I think that was just really clear down at CPAC, because CPAC, I don't think anyone argues anymore, as you said at the very front, is not the Star Wars bar. It is the party that was a reflection of what the party is, and there is no dissent.
Now, I understand the people who have a visceral reaction against working with Democrats. In fact, I remember when there were a lot of Democrats who became neoconservatives back in the 1970s, and many of them had a very, very hard time ever thinking of themselves as Republicans, because I think there's, you know, it's ingrained. It's hard to do. So there is going to be resistance. But I do think it is this particular moment we're in right now. Can I just read a little bit of what he's saying here? He said, you know, the debate, he said, for me at least, the proper debate about the future of conservatism and should you work across party lines, the proper debate should be about the country and the preservation of the democratic order. And the most important question is, what is now achievable and beneficial for America in the moment we actually live in? Well, I adhere to conservative principles, so I can't take this step. Is an understandable reaction to my suggestion. But I'd say it's not really a conservative reaction. A conservative considers the real world consequences of his or her principles. A conservative considers how adherence to or deviation from certain principles would help or hurt the goals conservatism seeks to achieve, because it is these goals, liberty, justice, good government, democracy, stability, and so on, that matter, not the ism. Conservatism is a means to those goals, not an end in of itself. This is an important point. And I think what happens when people get too deep into ideology, they forget what is the end, and begin to confuse the ends with the means, so that therefore this one principle, they adhere to it no matter what the real world consequences are. And then he quotes Margaret Thatcher as saying the facts of life are conservative. She wasn't adding the facts of life to a list of arguments for conservatism. She was saying she was conservative because the facts of life are what they are. And one of those facts, I'm reading from Bill Kristol's piece, one of those facts of life is that a dangerous anti-democratic faction, which pretty clearly constitutes a majority of the nation's conservative party, is not committed in any serious way to the truth, the rule of law, or the basic foundations of our liberal democracy. At bottom, I think we need to spend more time thinking through the challenges facing our democratic order today and less time gazing into the navel of American conservatism. That's well put.
Yeah, I mean, do you have to say than that? I just think that he's exactly right. And you know, as I said last week on the podcast, he has lived up to that, right? And I think that is the other key point here, is that, you know, you can, I think another disconnect between Bill and some of those on the right who have done the navel gazing and who sat on the sidelines throughout all of this and, you know, said they were never Trump but weren't ever willing to work with the Democrats, is an assessment of the threat risk, right? And, you know, I think that if you assess, which I do, and I think you do, that Donald Trump was a Democrat, was a fundamental threat to you know, our democratic traditions, to the country's democratic survival, then how can you just say, well, you know, I'm going to sit this one out because the Democrats, I disagree with them on right, you know, late term abortion. I disagree with them on late term abortion too. But like, you know, I mean, the question is an assessment of that anti-democratic majority in one party, as Bill laid out. I think if you see that clearly, there's only one way to land on this. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, you become a lockstep partisan hack on the other side or whatever. But it does mean recognizing the reality of what is happening in the country's conservative party.
Well, and I think this is also what we've discussed in the past, you know, the difference between the horizontal axis of left versus right and the vertical axis of truth, decency, democratic norms. I don't need to move to the left to say I'm willing to work with people who are not of my political party if, in fact, we think that preserving those norms, truth, rule of law, democratic norms, constitutional order, are in fact important. And and it's also not just that Donald Trump poses an existential challenge, because this is no longer one guy. This is again one of the shocks to me, because I remember back in 2016 there was Donald Trump, but there wasn't a lot of Trumpism or Trumpists right out there. Now what's obvious is that large segments of the Republican Party, probably a majority, have internalized these anti-democratic norms. And so that even if Donald Trump is taken off by his, you know, Diet Cokes and burgers, you do have this anti-democratic authoritarian strain. And whether it's going to be a, you know, Ted Cruz or a Hawley or a DeSantis or a Kristi Noem, that's still going to be an ongoing threat if you're willing to acknowledge that not all of our differences are on this left or right continuum.
Yeah, and at CPAC, it wasn't just that they had adopted some of these anti-democratic norms. It's the central policy, organizing policy principle of the party right now. I mean, every speech that I watched had somebody talking about the reforms that were needed to combat this fraud that they've hallucinated. That's what everybody talked about, how you need to make it harder to vote, you know, more stringent rules. I mean, you know, sure, in some places, some of these reforms, I'm sure, you know, we can look at the merits of the people who argue on different sides of various, you know, single issues as part of voting reform, but that's not what this was, right? It was a lockstep view that this election was stolen, so we need to make it harder to vote. We need to make it harder to vote in Philly and in Detroit. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And that was really, besides saying big tech companies bad, was like the only policy argument that was consistent throughout all the speeches. You know?
Well, okay. Now this is like slightly shifting it, but yes, and the other thing, and I wrote about this last week, I mean, you know, the right does have a white supremacy problem. And in the past, you've had leaders in the Republican Party who have been willing to address it. I'm not going to get into relitigating everything, but in my newsletter, I had another soundbite from Ronald Reagan when he spoke to the NAACP. Bob Dole said, you know, there's no place for bigots. You know, there's the exit. Especially because of Donald Trump, you can't, you know, say what Liz Cheney said, that Republicans need to make it absolutely clear they reject white supremacy without being exiled. So we had the Paul Gosar thing over the weekend where he goes and he speaks. This is an Arizona congressman goes and he speaks at a very explicitly white nationalist convention. This Nick Fuentes, who's basically a neo-Nazi, and he speaks there. And then he comes back and speaks at CPAC, and then he goes and he meets with Fuentes afterwards. Is that right? And you know they're gonna do nothing about him. There's, you know, Paul Gosar, who blew off the COVID vote because he said there was a, you know, health emergency, goes down and speaks to literal white racists, and then goes and speaks at CPAC. There will be no consequences. The party that expelled Steve King a few years ago, not expelled him, but I mean stripped him of his committee assignments, will take no action whatsoever. Because this is a party more invested in denying the reality of racism than confronting it or coming up with a way that Republicans ought to address it. So this is part of this lack of any introspection whatsoever. And this is a real problem, because it means that they're going to continue to turn a blind eye to it as it grows in influence and power as part of a constituency for the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Gosar's take was basically that, you know, these are young conservatives and we should be listening to them. I mean, Paul Gosar is, you know, and I've got this on also on my long writing list, you know, is just as crazy as MTG, by the way. And he's been there for a while now, but he, you know, he's getting, I think, more and more radicalized, but has always been crazy. And you know, there won't even be a discussion of any sort of reprimand of having somebody that spoke to an explicitly white nationalist organization in the caucus, you know, after this, you know, Sturm und Drang, you know, over Liz Cheney. What is acceptable and what is it not acceptable is very clear, and some people can try to talk around it or shade it or whatever, but you know, good hanging out, palling around with white supremacists is fine in the caucus. Saying something mean about Donald Trump is not. And, you know, if you do that, you get Chip Roy and his little mini Chip Roys holding a press conference outside the Capitol, finger wagging you. You know, Paul Gosar gets silence.
You know, what's interesting, you point out, as long as you say something nice about Donald Trump, you have a complete get out of jail pass ideologically. I was wondering if you actually went to CPAC and asked some of these participants, when you talk about socialism and the radical socialist agenda, can you define socialism and what exactly it is that the Democrats are doing that you describe as socialism that would not apply to, say, some of the things that Trump was doing or the Republicans were doing? Because, you know, sending out massive amounts of money to farmers, for example, that wouldn't be socialism if Trump does it. But it is going to be, you know, sending out money is going to be socialism if Biden does it. But you'll also notice that Josh Hawley is proving that as long as you suck up to Trump, you can take any left-wing position and you'll still be considered a quote-unquote conservative in good standing. But if you criticize Trump, then anything you do that deviates from conservative orthodoxy is a sign that you've become a squish, rhino, sellout, etc. Yeah.
Hawley talked about, it wasn't just big tech. In Hawley's speech, he talks about breaking up multinational corporations. He doesn't say which ones it is. But, you know, I mean, so Josh Hawley wants the government to be in charge of determining what can be posted on the internet. And he wants to break up, you know, the companies that have, you know, been the engines of a lot of the economic growth in this country. And then he wants to break up another unnamed sector worth of multinational corporations. And you know, that's not socialism. Look, it's cultural signaling, you know, I think. And I think that's why it's being replaced kind of by China, right? Like being tough on China. I mean, that was the other thing that is China that you see in all these speeches. It's tough on immigrants, tough on China, tough on big tech, and, you know, make it harder to vote, right? Like those, like, again, there's not a lot of
that's pretty much it right there
behind it, but like, that's it. That's what you're getting. And And so, you know, and not, again, not to do the nostalgia, because there's plenty of bad stuff about Reagan, but as part of my, you know, again, making sure that I was not the crazy one, I went back and watched Reagan's 86 CPAC speech, which has some crazy stuff in it. Like he shouts out kind of a revanchist Somalian, Angolan war, you know, because he was on the Stone Manafort payroll. So as much as things change, you know, they still seem to stay the same in some elements. But the vast majority of this speech was really just the three-legged stool policy. You know, it's like, you know, social policy, abortion, prayer in schools, and economic policy, you know, cutting regulations and spending and taxes and fighting the Soviets. I mean, that's like the whole speech. And so, you know, we can agree and disagree on some of the merits of those various, you know, issue points, but like the contrast between that and just this like guttural scream is so stark. And I think it's like the answer to your question, like what they think about what socialism is on a policy, you know, for a policy matter, like doesn't matter. It isn't that.
Right,
it's just this like
it's a word.
Bad. Other guys bad. Chinese bad. Immigrants bad. Rich people on the coast bad. Me good. Like
transgender athletes.
Yeah, transgender athletes bad. If we get money, if we get bailouts, that's good. That's not socialism. If they get money, if they get bailouts, that's bad. That is socialism. I wish it was, you know, more complex than that, and we could have, you know, arguments about it. But that is all it is.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Tim Miller, thanks for coming on the podcast and devoting so much of, and basically setting on fire your weekend to watch so much of CPAC for us.
Hey, anything for you, Charlie.
You won't get those days back, though. I'm telling you, they're gone, Tim. It's just flushed down the MAGA sewer. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. I hope I will be back tomorrow. And we'll do this all over again.